Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday, October 31, 2020. Virus resurgence sends oil prices to four-month low. WTI drops 1.1% to close at $35.79. By Mella McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. A grim week of news about COVID-19 sent markets, including oil markets, tumbling. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange recorded its steepest monthly drop since March, weakened by a record surge in coronavirus infections in the U.S. that threatened to reverse oil demand recovery. WTI fell 1.1% to close at $35.79 per barrel Friday, down from $38.56 at Monday's close. The posted price ended the week at $32.25 per barrel. West Texas sour ended the week below $35 a barrel. Natural gas prices moved in the opposite direction, rising 5 cents Friday to close at $3.35 per MCF. Prices got a boost when the near-month contract changed from November to December. The December contract closed its first day of trading Thursday at $3.30 per MCF. Michael Banschbach, oil, gas, and NGL marketing consultant, told the Reporter-Telegram by email that gas prices on the daily market at Waha were volatile all week, but seemed to have settled out by the end of the week. He attributed the volatility to a significant amount of pipeline maintenance. Joshua Gregg, chief financial officer at Double Eagle Energy Holdings, which is operating 6 rigs through its Double Point venture, told the Reporter-Telegram by email the company sees value in the current price environment. We continue to see development in the current commodity price environment, supported by the quality of our asset and our consistent well results, he wrote. The recent market volatility has shown how important asset and inventory quality is in this industry. We believe our team is a leader in the Permian Basin, and given our strong balance sheet and hedge position, we plan to remain active moving forward. Bloomberg reported that oil markets were taking their cue from the broader markets, which had their worst week since March amid the surge in virus cases. Bloomberg also cited new restrictions in Europe to battle a renewed surge in infections, which has raised concerns the region could see another recession. A return to tougher lockdown measures will likely deter a substantive rebound in airline demand, with more restrictions in Europe prompting further cuts in airline capacity for the remainder of the year, Bloomberg reported. Still, there's some support from booming freight markets and improvements in China and India. All the while, traders are looking ahead to next week's U.S. election and an OPEC Plus meeting at the end of November. Bloomberg added that the concerns over demand come at a time when the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies face a challenge in their efforts to keep supply in check with the faster-than-expected return in Libyan output. Iraq reaffirmed its support for the OPEC Plus oil production cuts and won't be seeking any exemption from the curbs next year, Oil Minister Ihsan Abdul Jabbar said. Meanwhile, Norway's largest oil field will pump at pre-COVID levels after receiving the government's permission last month. There's a really high level of insecurity out there surrounding the election, surrounding the path of economic growth, and this new surge in infections, Bill O'Grady, executive vice president at Confluence Investment Management in St. Louis, told Bloomberg. Until you get some evidence that things are starting to improve, it's going to be tough for crude to do better. Energy. U.S. rig count closes in on 300. Midland adds 5 rigs for a total of 20. By Mella McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. More drilling rig derricks are dotting the horizon as the rig count continues to rebound from record lows caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the oil market crash. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes and analytics firm Enverus said Friday the U.S. rig count rose 9 to 296 rigs, the 7th consecutive weekly increase. Still, the rig count is 526 rigs below the 827 at work nationwide a year ago at this time. Enverus reports the rig count is up 11% in the last month, but down 60% year over year. There were 221 rigs drilling for oil, up 10, and 72 rigs drilling for natural gas, down 1. Texas gained 8 rigs to report 133 at work within the state, 283 below the 416 at work a year earlier. New Mexico joined Texas in seeing an increase, gaining 2 rigs to 47. Oklahoma was the only producing state to see a decline, dipping 1 rig to 14. The Permian Basin added 9 rigs for a rig count of 142, 274 fewer than the 416 rigs at work last year. Eddy County, New Mexico, remained the most active in the Permian with 24 rigs, up 1 for the week. Lee County, New Mexico, followed with 23 rigs, also up 1 for the week. Midland County posted the sharpest increase among Permian Basin counties, climbing 5 rigs to 20 at work within county lines. Martin County had 18 rigs, down 1. Dawson and Reagan counties saw renewed activity for the week, each adding 1 rig. Invera said the Permian and the Gulf Coast saw the largest week-over-week gains, with multiple companies resuming activity after several months of inactivity and a number of companies spudding wells for the first time in 1 to 2 years. Notable changes in the Permian include Parsley Energy ramping up activity in the last week, adding 2 rigs and bringing its total to 4. The company had been running 2 rigs since mid-July. After taking a 7-month break, Hanathon Petroleum is back in action with 1 rig. On the Gulf Coast, CML Exploration added a rig at the end of September after not running away for 2 quarters. Kingwood Exploration added a rig after dropping its last one on July 10. Mesquite Energy, which exited bankruptcy at the end of July and changed its name from Sanchez Energy, reactivated its drilling program in late October after a drilling holiday that commenced in mid-March. Similarly, Venture Oil and Gas added a rig in the last week after dropping to 0 at the end of March. Price of gas doesn't change in Midland, by Stuart Doreen. S. Doreen at HurstMP.com. The average price of gas dropped in all but 3 larger markets in the state of Texas, and Midland was one of those markets where there was no change week over week. AAA Texas reported this week that the average price of gasoline stayed at $1.96 a gallon. This was the case even as the price dropped in Abilene, 2 cents, Amarillo, 4 cents, El Paso, 6 cents, Lubbock, 3 cents, and Odessa, 1 cent. The price remained the same in San Angelo as well. Across the state, the average price of gas dropped 3 cents to $1.86. The difference in the average price in Midland and across the state grew from 9 cents to 12 cents. Distributors have told the Reporter-Telegram there are many complexities in the fuel business that impact pricing. They pointed to the high cost of transportation from Gulf Coast refineries and Midland's distance from pipelines. AAA Texas reported in a press release that the average price at the pump statewide dropped to its lowest level since early August. Additionally, Texas drivers have been paying below $2 a gallon for regular unleaded on average for 230 days, according to historical data from gasprices.aaa.com. That is the longest time since the statewide average hit $2 a gallon for the first time in 2005, according to the organization. Odessa still has the highest average of any larger metropolitan area in the state, $2.04. Midland and El Paso are tied for second at $1.96. Those are the lone 3 areas with prices at or above $1.90 a gallon. Across the region, the other averages included $1.73 in Amarillo, $1.76 in Lubbock, $1.83 in San Angelo, and $1.88 in Abilene. Drivers in the Red River community of Sherman-Denison are paying the least in the state at $1.67 per gallon. The average price in Midland is 47 cents lower than it was 1 year ago. The average price across the state is 41 cents lower. This week, Odessa, $2.04. Midland, $1.96. El Paso, $1.96. Texarkana, $1.89. College Station, Bryan, $1.88. Abilene, $1.88. State average, $1.84. National average, $2.15. Last week, Odessa, $2.05. El Paso, $2.02. Midland, $1.96. Corpus Christi, $1.92. Abilene, $1.90. Texarkana, $1.90. Fort Worth, Arlington, $1.90. State average, $1.87. National average, $2.17. Source, AAA Texas. New COVID weekly high mark set in Midland, from staff reports. The Midland Health Department reported the highest number of COVID-19 cases in a week. The 70 cases announced Friday brought the weekly total to 561, which was 26 more than the 535 cases announced last week. Statistics also showed this week's increase was the sixth increase in weekly cases in 7 weeks, since September 6 through 12, when health department officials reported 79 cases in 1 week, a low during the summer. The cases announced Friday are reflective of lab results from part of the day Tuesday and Wednesday, according to the press release. The city of Midland also announced a death Friday, a woman in her 80s with underlying health conditions. The woman, who was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital, died Wednesday. It was the third death reported this week and the 95th during the pandemic. The health department also reported 2,130 active cases, an increase of 38 compared to Thursday and 347 compared to last week, and 3,051 recoveries, an increase of 30 compared to Thursday and 197 compared to last week. COVID-19 cases this week: Monday, 232, Tuesday, 83, Wednesday, 84, Thursday, 92, Friday, 70. Total this week, 561. Total during pandemic, 5,540. Most cases in a week: October 25 through 30, 561. October 19 through 24, 535. July 19 through 25, 418. August 2 through 8, 414. July 26 through August 1, 372. Source: Reporter Telegram Records. Obituaries. Joe H. Olgin. Joe H. Olgin, age 74, of Midland, passed away October 29, 2020. He was born January 15, 1946, in Midland, Texas. He graduated from Midland High School, class of 1965. He retired from the city of Midland after many years of service. He had a great personality and a big heart. He loved to make people laugh, loved to cook, loved to do yard work, and loved his grandchildren. Joe was a member of the Knights of Columbus organization. He was a man of faith. He was married to Mary Lara Olgin for 54 years and had 3 children. He is survived by his wife, 2 sons, Joe Olgin and wife Mary Olgin, John Olgin and his wife Irene Olgin, brothers Toribio Olgin, Melton Olgin, and Adolfo Olgin, grandchildren Jacob Nathaniel Olgin, Ryan Edward Olgin, Jordan Ray Miller, Alexi Mercedes Lopez, Amber Lynn Olgin, Isaac Adrian Olgin, and 6 great-grandchildren, Joshua Olgin, Anthony Olgin, Drew Miller, Darren Miller, Autumn Parsons, and Caleb Olgin. He was preceded in death by his parents, his daughter Belinda Fuentes, his grandson Richard Anthony Olgin, and his siblings Felix Flores, Raymond Olgin, Cipriano Olgin, Pablo Olgin, and Dominga Cruz. Viewing will take place on November 1, 2020, at 10 a.m., with a rosary to follow at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Mass services will be November 2, 2020, at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Pallbearers are Robert Olgin, Melton Olgin Jr., Raymond Espinoza, Feliz Diaz, Antonio Ruiz Jr., and Jesus Delgado. The family would like to express their gratitude towards all the thoughts and prayers we have received. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin at nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Death Notices. Jefferson Smith, Jr. Jefferson L. Smith, Jr., 87, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, October 27, 2020, in Robert Lee, Texas. Services for Mr. Smith will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, October 31st, 2020. Section A. 2020 Early Voters Turnout by Michael Merlot. Early voter numbers have broken records around Texas in 2020, and in Ector County, 35,513 were cast as early voting ended Friday. The Texas Tribune detailed that early voters have turned out statewide and that more than 9 million Texans had cast their ballots, making up 53.1% of the state's registered voters, surpassing the state's total votes cast in 2016. The Tribune also detailed that around 47.6% of those people voted in person and 5.6% have voted by mail. Ector County Elections Administrator Lisa Sertuch said that this year early voter turnout has passed the 2016 total of 26,377 early voters. An Ector County Elections Office November 2016 cumulative report detailed that the combined number of early votes and Election Day votes came out to a total of 37,284 ballots cast. Sertuch said that 10,907 votes were cast on Election Day in 2016. Sertuch and other employees in the election offices have been swamped, she said via phone Friday, as voters try to beat the rush on Election Day, she said. Ector County voters will have a total of 25 polling places that will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday. She said that she believed all the vote centers will be steady and that all of the polling places will most likely have lines. As far as poll watchers in Ector County polling places, Sertuch said that the only people watching the polls would be those registered to do so with either the Ector County Republican Party or the Ector County Democratic Party. I don't foresee anyone just trying to go in and go because they have to present an appointment of certificate, she said. Aside from the presidential election, this year's ballot contains multiple regional and city elections, including Odessa's city council, mayoral election, U.S. Representative for District 11, U.S. Senator, Railroad Commissioner, Chief Justice Supreme Court, Justice Supreme Court spots, among others. Different area sample ballots can be located at https://tinyurl.com/y52q8vn9, and state voting statistics via the Texas Tribune can be located at tinyurl.com/majzz4v. Voting centers. The following locations will be open during Election Day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday. United Market, formerly Albertsons, 1350 East 8th. United Market, 2751 North County Road West. Crossroads Fellowship, room 1135, 6901 Highway 191 frontage. Ector County Coliseum, west end of Southwest Hallway, 4201 Andrews Highway. First Church of the Nazarene, Gymnasium, 2223 Lindale. Gardendale Community Building, 4225 East Larkspur, Gardendale. Gethsemane Church Fellowship Hall, 8431 South 385. Goldsmith Community Building, 301 Avenue H, Goldsmith. Kellis Turner Community Building, 2230 Sycamore Drive. Kingston Avenue Baptist Church Fellowship Hall, 5200 Kingston Avenue. Lincoln Tower Ballroom, 311 West 4th. Lutheran Church of the Risen Lord, Foyer, 1603 North Grandview. Murray Fly Elementary, Foyer, 11688 West Westview. Northside Senior Center, Multipurpose Room, 1225 North Adams. Globe Theater at Odessa College, 2308 Shakespeare Road. Odessa Christian Faith Center, 180 Youth Building, Sanctuary, 8828 Andrews Highway. PAL Center, 1015 North County Road West. Salinas Community Building, 600 West Clements. Sherwood Community Building, 4819 North Everglade. Slater Community Building, 1001 West 38th. St. Elizabeth's Catholic Church, Gymnasium, 7601 North Grandview. VFW Bingo Hall, Non-Smoking Room, 208 East 63rd. Westlake Hardware, 4652 East University. Wilson's Corner, Dining Room, 16514 South US 385. Woodson Community Building, 1010 East Murphy. District Working to Increase Attendance by Ruth Campbell. Ector County ISD's attendance is not where the district would like it at this point in the year. The drops appear to be at the high school, pre-kindergarten, and kindergarten levels. Director of School Attendance Scott Randolph, who works out of the Community Outreach Center, said high school attendance is down about 7%, but the elementary schools are getting close to where they were last year. Superintendent Scott Murray said the district has about 32,000 students enrolled this year, which is about 2,000 off from what was projected. He noted that enrollment is different from attendance. You can be enrolled in ECISD, but not go to class or school every day. Murray said those 2,000 students are mainly missing in pre-kindergarten and kindergarten. The high schools, in terms of enrollment, are the group that's doing the best and are a little bit ahead of what was predicted. Middle school, 6th grade and 7th grade are lower than projected, Murray said. 8th grade is above projection, but as a whole, the middle schools are slightly below what ECISD projected. Schools are partly funded by the state based on attendance. He said the 7% equates to about 7,000 students. It's just a continuous process of trying to improve our systems. I've been sending lots of warning letters, Randolph said. This will be the first week that we submit truancy charges, so we really need parents to know that attendance is still required by state law. You can attend virtually or you can attend in person, but you've got to do one or the other. You can't just sit out there and not do either. If you're having a significant drop at 7,000 students, it's a difficult issue that needs to be addressed. We're hoping that it will start picking back up, he added. As students phase back into school, Randolph said attendance should pick back up, but students have to log in consistently if they're virtual or attend in person. ECISD police were conducting welfare checks during the summer, and Randolph said they are still helping with home visits. We have social workers here that also do home visits all the time. Those are for the cases where the kids just aren't responding. The majority of them, they're responding. They may just log in one day and the next day not. I'm talking about 20% of our kids. About 80% are doing awesome. They're logging in when they should. They're doing exactly what we ask of them, and they're doing great. There is about 20% of them that are struggling with the new paradigm. We've got to get them on board, get their parents on board. It should get better. Last year, ECISD averaged about 93.6% attendance. If I'm remembering correctly, the high schools would be at about 92% roughly every day. So right now they're at about 84, somewhere around there, 85%. Middle school is struggling also. Again, a lot of it is remote, Randolph said. For remote learners, they have to log in at every period. The kids who are staying home, we're trying to educate them and say, look, if there's 6 periods in a day and you're going to stay home, you have to log in 6 periods in a day. You have to attend those classes, so little retraining efforts like that to make sure the parents know and the kids know. If you're going to stay home, you have to log in each period. That's the deal. You don't just stay home and sleep in and log in when you feel like it. Imagine you're going to school, but you're at home. Parents who have to work depend on their children to log in when they are supposed to and tell their parents the truth when they get home. It's one of those things that parents, most of them, are doing the best they can right now. It's not an ideal situation, but it's kind of become the new normal, so hopefully it will get better. Some of them don't have the best internet. They think they're logged in, and then the teacher will say, "I didn't see you," Randolph said. He added that any password issues should have been resolved by now. Recently, the Community Outreach Center offered students a chance to re-enroll in school. Since they hadn't re-enrolled, they were coming up as dropouts. Randolph said a few were signed up, but numbers are small once the district is this far into recovery efforts. We still have families who say, "I was just waiting it out to see what the response would be if the virus got super bad because the kids came back to school," Randolph said. Yesterday, October 20th, we had a family who came in and said they were ready to come back. Randolph also oversees truancy. If a family has three or more unexcused absences, they are mailed a warning letter, which is required by state law. It just tells them, hey, here are the laws. It gives them a QR code where they can watch a little video. They can scan a little video and watch it on their phone about the truancy laws. If they keep missing, then at 5 unexcused absences, we send them a final warning notice. It tells them, hey, you're about to go to court. Let's try and resolve this. It also gives them a QR code that just shows them a general video on attendance. The schools are also providing interventions, so we have to implement what are called truancy prevention measures, Randolph said. The schools call the parents and tell them that their child has too many absences, tries to find out what the problem is, and what can be done to fix the situation. A lot of times the parents just weren't really aware or didn't understand it had gotten that bad. Most of the parents can correct the problem just with that conference at school, but some of the other reasons continue, so the next step would be at 10 unexcused absences or when we file charges against the parents. It's called parent contributing to non-attendance, a Class C misdemeanor. We actually file those charges in municipal court. They have a truancy court that deals with these. Randolph said his office files the complaint and the next step is that the court calls them in, tries to talk to them about the charges, what they've tried to do to fix the problem, and then ultimately they decide what will happen, whether they dismiss it or whether they conduct a jury trial. He said the parent contributing to non-attendance has been around for years and is just one tool that Texas districts can use to keep students going to school. If you enroll a child in pre-kindergarten or kindergarten, Randolph said, the law says they have to keep going. He added that once the district switched to full-day pre-kindergarten, attendance has gone up from 91 or 92% to 95%. They must complete the school year in which they turn 19. If you complete school before age 19, that's okay too. Randolph's Community Outreach Center has 4 social workers who also work as attendance officers. They talk to families all day that are having attendance problems, and we try to provide resources to remove the problems. We have a food bank in here. We have a clothes closet. We have school supplies. We try to remove all the little barriers that families have sometimes. They can't afford a uniform, and sometimes their priority is to get food. So the social workers have all those resources and more, so they can get that family right then to remove those barriers, Randolph said. Many times, he said, there are underlying issues of trauma or domestic violence, for example, so they view attendance as the tip of the iceberg. That's why we have the social workers try to work with the family to figure out, so the issue isn't really attendance. However, if the non-attendance continues, Randolph said, the charges are filed. Along with 4 social workers who handle roughly 10 schools each, there are 3 staff members who work in their dropout recovery program, where we actually have kids who come to school here, Randolph said. There are three clerical staff members, a dropout specialist at Permian High School, and a dropout specialist at Odessa High School. The COC also provides help to homeless families. He said there are about 850 students who fall under the federal definition this year. Randolph said this year Murray has allowed students to stay at their home campuses, which he said has helped. In the past, certain schools would be capped that would send people all over the city. So Dr. Murray said that was one of the great things he did, was say, if you live in that zone, you're going to be able to go there. How that helped the homeless is they get to actually stay at those schools, and they weren't out there trying to enroll without the documentation in their zone. So that basically let them continue at those schools they were at last year, Randolph said. I think they're happy they got to stay in the school they were in last year. It's really a big deal, especially to kids who develop friends and get to know their teachers. Many of your McKinney Ventos, they were just constantly switching schools. You'd see they'd be to 6 to 8 elementaries. How can they flourish if they're constantly having to adjust to new teachers, new friends? Kids need stability. They need routine, he added. Democracy at the drive-in. The Ector County Democrats and Midland County Democratic Party have scheduled Democracy at the Drive-In Tuesday at Big Sky Drive-In Theater, 6200 West Highway 80 in Midland. VIP gates open at 6 p.m. and general admission at 6:30 p.m. Space is limited, so carpooling where safe is strongly recommended. There will be a Joe Biden Kamala Harris auto decorating contest. Democratic merchandise will be available. Security will be on site. Masks and social distancing are required. Tickets will be available at the gate. Visit tinyurl.com/Y3UGKWOB or www.bigskytheater.com. Overeaters Anonymous. Overeaters Anonymous, a 12-step support group, has scheduled the following Zoom meetings. Sundays, 6 p.m. ID 964-152-377. Passcode WE. Mondays, noon. ID 420-773-870. Passcode 061284. Wednesdays, 8 a.m. ID 338-141-943. Passcode 026193. Meetings are free and open to the public. For more information, call 553-1031 or visit oa.org. Project to rehabilitate section of Highway 385 to begin in November. A project to rebuild nearly 10 miles of U.S. Highway 385 in northern Ector County is scheduled to begin in November, a Texas Department of Transportation press release stated. The project reportedly goes from FM 1882 West County Road to the Andrews County Line. Work is scheduled to begin at the Andrews County Line and move south. The project is expected to take about 18 months to complete and should be finalized in mid-2022. In addition to rehabilitating and resurfacing the road, a southbound turn lane and a northbound acceleration lane will be reportedly added at Cottonwood Road. Other crossovers along the corridor will also be improved, while overhead illumination is planned at Cottonwood Road. Signage and some drainage structures will be replaced. Lane closures will be needed in the project, but one lane will always be kept open in both directions on the main lanes, the press release stated. A construction zone speed limit of 60 miles per hour will be reportedly in place for the project. A construction zone speed limit of 45 miles per hour will be in place near the intersections of Highway 158 and Loop 338 when work is occurring in those areas. A width restriction of 12 feet will also be in place through the work zone, the press release stated. Jones Brothers Dirt and Paving of Odessa won the project with a low bid of more than $20.1 million. Midland College hosts free historical lecture. The Midland College Fasken Learning Resource Center will host a lecture featuring Sarah Peterson and K.W. Zachary, authors of The Lone Star Speaks, at 6 p.m. Thursday. The event is free and open to the public. The book is an in-depth look at the assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy. The presentation will be in a virtual format and moderated by William Christopher Brown, M.C. English professor. The book provides new insights into the Kennedy assassination and uses witness testimony to raise further questions concerning what many have called the crime of the 20th century. Peterson and Zachary became interested in Kennedy's assassination at a young age. Zachary's grandparents lived in Dallas in 1963 and saved newspapers from that era. Peterson became interested in the assassination in 1978 when she participated in the Presidential Classroom for Young Americans program in Washington, D.C. The two have collected books and artifacts concerning the assassination for years. Both authors are currently employed by Midland College and began their writing journey in 2014 with a presentation at the MC West Texas Symposium of History. Soon they expanded into a four-year research project that resulted in the authors finding and interviewing more than 150 individuals. To join, go to https://www.midland.edu/calendar/index.php?eid=1638. The Microsoft Teams live link is tinyurl.com/Lone Star Speaks. For more information, contact Howard Marks at 432-685-4726 or email hmarks@midland.edu. Obituary and death notices for Saturday, October 31st. Chad Allen Neese. Zavala. Chad Allen Neese was born January 20th, 1993, and passed away at the age of 27 on October 22nd. He is preceded in death by his brother, Christopher Lawrence. He is survived by his beloved, Samantha Gears, his parents, Mark and Catherine Neese, his mother, Christina Rimes, sisters Jennifer Patterson, Kayla Pierce, and Alexa Neese, grandparents Ladue Neese and Sherry Rimes, as well as aunts, uncles, nieces, a nephew, and many brothers and sisters in Christ. A memorial service was held Saturday, October 31st at Rolling Sevens Ranch in Midland. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Death notices. Ventura Sanchez. Ventura Sanchez, 78, of Fort Stockton, died Wednesday, October 28th in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. November 3rd at Our Lady of Guadalupe Downtown Campus, Fort Stockton. Burial will follow at Catholic Cemetery. Arrangements are by Heritage Funeral Home, Big Bend of Fort Stockton. Chester Ray Cleaver, Sr. Chester Ray Cleaver, Sr., 76, died Monday, October 26th. In Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Mark Allen Dominguez. Mark Allen Dominguez, 63, of Odessa, died Wednesday, October 28th. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. David Allen McInnes. David Allen McInnes, 58, of Odessa, died Monday, October 26th. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, November 1st, 2020. Election 2020. Voting, Question and Answers by Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. Is there anyone left to vote? The Midland County Elections website reported that 46,139 Midland County residents voted during the early voting period. That included more than 4,000 on Friday, the final day. Add in the number of mail-in ballots received, 3,365, and 49,504 votes have already been cast. That is 54.61% of the registered voters in the county. The 49,504 votes are also 194 away from the total number of voters who participated in the 2016 general election. During the 2016 election, 80,329 eligible voters participated. Will President Trump be as popular? Midland County voters have overwhelmingly supported the Republican Party's candidate for president in recent memory. In 2016, President Trump picked up 74.75% of the votes for president inside Midland County. Hillary Clinton picked up 20.27%. Trump's percentage is actually the lowest percentage for Republican candidates running for president in Midland County since 2004. The highest was George Bush in 2004. Are runoffs a possibility in the Midland ISD races? Yes, Midland ISD has two races with three candidates, District 1 and District 4. A candidate must collect a majority of those votes, 50% plus 1, to claim victory. In 2018, there were two three-person MISD races. One ended with the winner collecting 38.57% of the vote, forcing a runoff. Will the lack of straight-ticket voting matter? Here's what we know. Straight-ticket voting is not an option this year. In the past, Midlanders were active when it came to straight-ticket voting. For instance, nearly 29,000 did in 2016. Over the last four presidential elections, the percentage of those voting straight ticket for a party was consistent with the party Midland County residents picked for president. Could there be an impact with local results this year? The answer is probably not. The reason is there really isn't a local race that a straight party vote would have covered. Too many candidates down ballot are running unopposed or uncontested. Election by the numbers. 0. Number of straight party ballots turned in. This was the first general election where straight party voting question wasn't allowed in the state of Texas. 2. The number of competitive Midland College races on the ballot. In place 7, Adrian Carrasco, Will Green, and Sean Rainey are in the ballot. In place 8, the candidates are Scott Lynch and Ralph Way. In place 9, Scott Tidwell didn't draw an opponent. 3. Number of MISD board members running for re-election. Only John Kennedy in District 4 chose to seek another term. 4. Number of competitive Midland ISD races on the ballot. In District 1, the candidates are Michael Booker, Matt Galindo, and James Fuller. District 2, the candidates are Rachel Davis, Robert Marquez. In District 4, the candidates are competing for an open seat are Joel Deal, Katie Joyner, and Steve Vargas. In District 7, names on the ballot are Joseph Gallegos and Brian Murray. 5. Number of different elections in 2020 in Midland County. District 2, special city election, primary elections, hospital sales tax election, primary runoffs, general election. There are no elections currently scheduled for 2021. 12. Number of hours of voting that will take place on Election Day, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 13. Number of candidates running for president, including write-in candidates. 15. The number of Election Day voting centers located in churches. 16. The number of different ways a person could vote in person early. The normal number of days is 12. 16. The number of local representative races where candidates are running unopposed. 13 Republicans and 2 Democrats in one Midland College race. 21. Number of Election Day voting centers. 26. Number of general elections State Representative Tom Craddock will have won after Tuesday. Craddock was first elected in 1968 at age 25. The former Speaker of the House is a longest-serving member of the Texas legislature in state's history. 32. Number of years Midland ISD board member James Fuller has been on the board. 66, number of combined years that Midland College representatives Will Green and Ralph Way have been served on the board. 71, the expected high temperature on Election Day, according to the National Weather Service. The forecast calls for mostly sunny skies during the day, mostly clear skies at night, and a low of 48. 81.59, the percentage of votes in Midland County collected by George Bush in 2004. It was the highest percentage for a presidential candidate in Midland County in the last 16 years. 3,365, number of ballots by mail that had been reported. 4,005, number of voters in Midland County who voted on the final day of early voting, the most on any one day during the early voting period. 46,139, the number of Midland County voters who cast a ballot during the early voting period. The previous record was 39,098 in 2016. 90,642, number of registered voters in Midland County this year, a greater than 20% increase compared to 2016. Where 11th Congressional District candidates stand on the issues, by Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. Election Day is 2 days away. Here is a rundown of the candidates for Texas's 11th Congressional District and their stances on local and national issues. Their answers are compiled from interviews with the Reporter Telegram and a debate hosted by PBS on October 12th. On the transfer of high-level nuclear waste through Midland County to a proposed temporary storage site in Edgers County. Both Republican nominee August Pfluger and Democratic nominee John Mark Hoag have said they oppose the storage and transportation of high-level waste in the Permian Basin. Pfluger has said the proposal in Andrews County, which calls for a temporary storage site to be used until a permanent repository is available, is evidence of a failure of the federal government to establish a permanent location for nuclear waste after the Yucca Mountain project was never completed. He said the federal government has failed to secure a location that won't compromise resident safety. Hoag has been vocal about his opposition to the proposed Andrews site throughout his campaign. He said he is against any plan to bring nuclear waste to West Texas, whether permanently or temporarily, and he believes transporting waste to Andrews in casks on trains also puts the surrounding area, including Midland County, at risk. On whether education should be a federal or state issue, the candidates differ in their views on education, with Pfluger saying the federal government should not be involved in education, and Hoag saying it is a state issue and that schools should also receive federal funding. Pfluger has said the local school district and parents should have the most say in children's education, and the federal government should not dictate education requirements. He also said federal funding should not go toward teaching the arts in school, and arts should be learned outside of school on a private level. In contrast, Hoag said that while he believes education is a state issue, schools and teachers should be given more federal funding. Additionally, he said more funding for arts education should be available to schools through the National Endowment of the Arts. On fracturing and representing the Permian Basin's oil industry, both candidates have said they support fracturing and would oppose a ban on fracturing, with Hoag differing from some national Democratic leaders who have called for either a ban or limitations on the practice. Hoag said he would not support any measures against fracturing and believes it's an essential global resource and necessary to sustain the country's economy. However, he has also said West Texas should diversify its economy by investing in renewable energy, which he acknowledged is not possible without fracturing. Pfluger has said fracturing, along with oil and gas, are instrumental to national security and the economy, and he has advocated for creating a level playing field with other countries to protect U.S. oil interests. Additionally, Hoag has voiced support for a national policy to maintain oil prices, while Pfluger has said the government should not be involved in setting the price of oil. On COVID-19 and government mandates, the candidates agree on national mandates, both saying they oppose any nationwide shutdowns or mask mandates. Hoag said has called for a national policy to combat the coronavirus, which would involve increased funding for testing and contact tracing. He has also been critical of President Trump's response to the virus and said the administration wasted a golden opportunity to stop the spread of COVID-19. Pfluger has praised Trump's response and said the most important aspect of the pandemic is to ensure there will be no national mandates. He also said he opposes any national policy and believes virus response should be handled by the states. On immigration reform and border security, the candidates have opposing views on border security and addressing immigration. Pfluger has said the nation's borders need to be secured before immigration reform can be addressed, and he has indicated he supports the wall between the U.S. and Mexico that was a hallmark of Trump's 2016 campaign. On the other hand, Hoge said that the country's borders can't be secured until the U.S.'s immigration system is fixed, making legal immigration easier. And he said technology, rather than border walls, should be used to enhance border security. On gun reform, the candidates fall along party lines with their views on gun reform. Hogg has called for common sense gun reform, including red flag laws and universal background checks. He has said guns are not the cause of the country's frequent mass shootings, but are a component, and the U.S. causal gun culture should be addressed. When asked during October 12th debate how he would protect Texans from gun violence, Pfluger said the greater issue is those who want to take the Second Amendment away. He also said more laws would not stop people who are intent on breaking the law, and the country should be doing more to address mental health. COVID forces closure of Washington STEM by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstMP.com. COVID-19 enforced the closure of Washington STEM Academy last week. MISD's website showed that Washington's campus was closed on Thursday. It is expected to reopen Monday. A list of reported cases shows 24 involving staff or students at Washington STEM, October 20th through Thursday, October 21st, and October 24th and 6th on Monday. The Washington STEM PTA's Facebook page shows the school was canceled on Tuesday and Wednesday because of bad weather. The Facebook page then shows no school for students on Thursday because of parent-teacher conferences and a student holiday on Friday, teacher work day. MISD also is requiring students and staff to wear face masks at school when they return this week, according to the PTA Facebook. Health experts say that mask wearing is one of the most effective tools available to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, and the CDC indicates that children 2 years and older should wear a mask, according to the Facebook page. This is a directive from Midland ISD to all campuses. A call out went out earlier this week with this information. The closure of a campus or facility was the first since August 20th and the fifth overall. In addition to the district-wide snow days on Tuesday and Wednesday, Thursday and Friday were planned student holidays, Atlanta Ladd stated in an email to the Reporter Telegram. Due to the number of COVID-19 cases associated with Washington, Washington staff worked from home on Thursday and Friday. This allowed additional days of disinfection of the building and prolonged the number of days without in-person contact at Washington. MISD is focused on keeping schools open safely as we continue to deliver instruction and fulfill our mission of preparing students for college and career. The total number of confirmed cases inside the district is up to 320 since June the 2nd. Lee High School has the most of any campus, 40. The next top five campuses are Midland High with 35, Washington 24, Lee Freshman at 18, San Jacinto at 16, Goddard at 11, and Alamo Junior High with 10 at the only other campuses with 10 more. Midland ISD has said that each notification triggers a series of steps, which include sanitizing and disinfecting, notification of individuals in close proximity, and notification to the health department. Anytime we become aware of an individual with a confirmed case who was present at a public gathering, such as a board meeting or sporting event, we will also issue a press release. Death notices and obituaries. Margarita Gamboa, 84, of Midland, went to be with our Lord on Wednesday, October 28. A visitation will begin from 12 to 9 p.m. on Sunday, and a prayer service 7 to 9 p.m. on Sunday evening at Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory. Services will be at 1 p.m. on Monday, November 2nd, at Templo Batista de la Hermosa. Nina Willis of Midland died unexpectedly on October 24th, peacefully in her sleep. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 5th at Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Services will be 2 p.m. Friday, November 6th at Nellie Pickelon Welsh Funeral Home and Chapel in Midland. Cliff Buchanan, 79, of Odessa, passed away on October 1st. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, November 7th at the United Universal Church in Odessa at 11 a.m. Phoenix Dale Miller, 92, of Midland, passed away Wednesday, October 28th. Graveside service will be Monday, November 2nd at 2 p.m. at Fairview Cemetery.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.